Cornea.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Reed Cornea appearing for Quentin Lomax. I know I'm making a special appearance for Chris Malloy, who is attorney of record in this appeal, as well as the trial counsel in this case. May it please the court, Ms. Bumbleau. The crux of this appeal is, did Quentin Lomax provide a just reason to withdraw his appeal? Now, Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure allows a defendant to withdraw a plea for a just and fair reason. And he can do this before a sentence is imposed. A court needs to look at the sufficiency of the Rule 11 colloquy carried out by the district court and depends on a number of factors. First, the complexity of the charges in the case. This was a charge of a felon in possession of a firearm, as well as a possession with intent for a cocaine base. I note that the gun count was dismissed. The court also needs to look at the defendant's age and intelligence. The court needs to look at the judge's inquiry and the defendant's statement to that inquiry. And finally, the court needs to look at the government's evidentiary proffer. Now, I'll touch on each of those, but I want to start with the plea hearing itself. During the plea hearing, as is practice in that court, Judge Shabazz read the plea agreement letter to the defendant to make sure the defendant understood. And the paragraph that is of importance in this case is deals with the acceptance of responsibility. And I'll quote that from you, part of it. Quote, and the United States is free to withdraw this recommendation or acceptance of responsibility should you have previously engaged in any conduct which is unknown to the United States and is inconsistent with acceptance of responsibility, or should you engage in any conduct between the date of this plea agreement and the sentencing hearing which is inconsistent with the acceptance of responsibility. That's at the page 9 and 10 of the trial transcript. The plea hearing transcript. Mr. Lomax followed the terms of that agreement. He did nothing between the signing of the plea agreement and the plea hearing and the sentencing hearing to violate those terms. The government, on the other hand, did violate those terms. Let's look at what Mr. Lomax did throughout the course of this case, or what he maintained. Since the day of his arrest, Mr. Lomax maintained the gun was not his. And in fact, once the government had fingerprints run on the firearm and a box of ammunition found, and fingerprints or a palm print came back on the ammunition showing that it wasn't Mr. Lomax, it was somebody else that they didn't know who it was, the government quickly proceeded to seek a plea agreement in this case and to dismiss count one of the indictment, the felon in possession of a firearm. Prior to the government's plea offer, Mr. Lomax had every intention of going to trial on the issue of possession of a firearm by a felon. The government's proffer at the plea hearing did not mention the firearm. And there's nothing in the plea colloquy to suggest that the government still intended to hold him accountable for the firearm. Now, the real problem in this case stems from the relevant conduct as it's applied under the advisory guidelines. And the Western District of Wisconsin has an exceedingly independent probation and parole department. They do a very good job in many ways, but they are exceedingly independent. Once the pre-sentence investigation report was filed, Mr. Lomax discovered that the probation officer recommended to the judge that a 2-point firearm enhancement be included in the sentence, despite the fact that Mr. Lomax's fingerprints were not on the firearm and on the ammunition, and in spite of the fact that somebody else's fingerprints were there and present. Probation and parole also made the determination to recommend a 2-point enhancement based on hearsay of a police report. The police report in question noted, written by Officer Denise Markham of the Madison City Police Department, noted that in searching the apartment, Lucretia Brown, Mr. Seymour, Mr. Lomax's girlfriend, stated something to the effect of, he keeps it here. Where she pointed to, the gun wasn't there. And in fact, the officers found the gun underneath the bed, independent of what she said. Ms. Brown has denied ever making that statement. She filed affidavits to that effect for sentencing and for the Rule 11 hearing. So the probation and parole and the government received these affidavits, and things got nasty.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Things got nasty, at least from Mr. Lomax's point of view.
Well, how many boyfriends does this woman have?
This woman? I can't tell you. All I know is that, and I think it was established, that he stayed at Ms. Brown's house two or three times a week.
Right, and wasn't there something in the affidavit about how often he stayed there?
Pardon?
Was there something in the affidavit that she submitted how frequently he stayed there?
I believe so. And I think that was also in the interviews that probation and parole did, if my memory is correct. And again, I'm not as familiar with these facts as I would like to be. I was given this case last week. I believe that she also indicated to probation and parole that he was there two to three times a week to spend the night. Regardless, once these affidavits were submitted...
I guess my point is it was not a monogamous situation?
From his point of view, it certainly wasn't. I'll put it that way. I know that for sure.
I mean, just getting back to the gun and the ammunition, I mean, that's, obviously she says it wasn't... What did she say in the affidavit? Did she say it was hers?
I believe so. She claimed it was hers.
But there's no evidence that her prints were on the gun. Right?
No, there's no evidence that her prints were.
There were some prints, and at this point. And she was tested. Do we know?
I do not know if she was tested. To be honest with you, I don't believe she was actually. But Ms. Rumble may be able to clarify that. But it's my understanding that the prints that were discovered, they don't know who they were.
But. The defense counsel below receives his pre-sentence report and moves him with dispatch to withdraw the plea?
No. What happens is Mr. Malloy goes and talks to Mr. Lomax about the gun enhancement. Mr. Lomax, again, as he has been throughout this case, says, no, the gun's not mine. I did not want that enhancement. That's unfair. And so...
He directs counsel to make the motion to withdraw?
No, not at this point. They filed the affidavit in hopes of providing, well, they wrote the objections to the PSR. And in that PSR, they objected to the enhancement and included the affidavit from Ms. Brown saying the gun was hers.
So at what point do they make the motion to withdraw, Mr. Carnegie?
The motion came to withdraw once it was... indicated to defense counsel that the government would be seeking not only the removal of acceptance responsibility in this case, but also seeking...
I'm just trying to get a timeline. The pre-sentence report is received by counsel. He discusses it.
They go through it, correct.
And does counsel speak to the government at this point about the government's position, what it's about to be at sentencing? Is there any contact?
Generally, at least in my experience, there's not. I don't know if Mr. Molloy did actually have contact.
Well, maybe Ms. Rumbelow could help us.
I do know that they filed their objections to the PSR, which is what we usually do. And in part of those objections, they objected to the enhancement.
I understand.
And in support of that, they included the affidavit.
So then the day of sentencing arrives, and they make a motion to withdraw. Is that what happened?
Yes, although the motions came just a couple of days before that when Mr. Malloy received notice that the government would be seeking to take away the acceptance of responsibility.
Was that the government did that after the affidavit was filed?
Yes, the government did that after the affidavit was filed, and they also were seeking to have it enhanced even further for obstruction of justice. And that's at that point, Mr. Malloy sat down and spoke with Mr. Lomax and discussed what they wanted to do. Mr. Lomax, having been very pointed in his statements about the gun not being his, decided that he wanted to go to trial on the issue of the gun.
So then they appear on the scheduled date for sentencing.
They have a Rule 11 hearing followed by sentencing. The police officers testify. They talk about what happened, statements that were made. I think they were rather... they'd interviewed Ms. Lomax prior, or excuse me, Ms. Brown prior to the grand jury hearing, and at that point they stated, she stated in another affidavit that she said the gun was not his. The officer said that she never stated that prior to the grand jury testimony. She continues to state that she did say the gun was not his at that point.
Now, she didn't testify at the sentencing hearing,
she didn't testify at the sentencing hearing. And
her
she
affidavit was there.
Her affidavit was there.
One of the officers testified.
Yeah. That's correct.
And that officer who testified, his statement was primarily hearsay.
Primarily hearsay. And in fact, the officer says at that hearing, she did not say anything about a gun. But then when pressed on a cross-examination, the officer couldn't remember what was asked and what was said. Both officers who were cross-examined on that, they were like, well, you know, we don't know what was said, but we're sure she didn't say anything about the gun. So in this case, I think Mr. Lomax has offered a just reason and a fair reason to have his case, to have his plea withdrawn and to allow it to go to trial on the issue of the gun and concomitantly the cocaine. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Ms. Rumbelow.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rita Rumbelow, on behalf of the United States. On November 14th, 2005, Madison Police Department officer Denise Markham went to an apartment building that she had learned Quentin Lomax was living at, to arrest him on an outstanding warrant. She was outside the apartment building. She observed Quentin Lomax exit the apartment building. She arrested him on the outstanding warrant. She had to use pepper spray because he resisted arrest. He had $1,600 in his pocket. He asked to go up to the apartment to rinse his eyes and to say goodbye to his baby. Officer Markham accompanied him up there.
His baby.
And in the meantime, called for backup, Officer Dave Wixom. So Officer Markham's in the apartment. Lakeisha Brown answers.
She goes up before the backup arrives?
I think maybe Officer Wixom arrived at the same time. That was never clear. But they go up there. Lakeisha answers the door. Quentin Lomax rinses his eyes, says goodbye to his baby, and then other officers remove him from the apartment, and Officer Denise Markham and Dave Wixom remain in the apartment with Lakeisha Brown. Denise Markham says to Lakeisha, Lakeisha, we hear Quentin has a gun. We know about this. Is it here? Lakeisha started moving towards the bedroom door of the apartment, and she stopped. She hesitated. There was something in the bedroom she didn't want Officer Markham to see. Officer Markham says, is it a little bit of marijuana? No. And then Officer Markham says, is it cocaine, crack? Lakeisha says, yes. Officer Markham says, don't worry about it. We're worried about the gun that we've heard that Quentin has. So Lakeisha walks into the bedroom apartment, starts looking through dresser drawers, and says, this is where he usually keeps it. Now, Officer Markham and Officer Wixom testified to this at the sentencing hearing. So they go through it, and finally they find the gun under the mattress. And then they ask Lakeisha, does he have any ammunition? She goes into the kitchen, gets the ammunition. So on November 14th, 2005, according to the testimony of two Madison police officers, this is what transpires in the apartment. Now, they did find over 5 grams of cocaine base on the nightstand next to the bed, which was very close, and the gun was located under the mattress of the bed. The nightstand with the crack cocaine was approximately 5 feet away, if that, from where this loaded pistol, or I don't know if it was loaded, but where this pistol was found. The government then presents a 2-count indictment to the grand jury.
Let me go back for a minute. Wixom heard her say that it was his gun, or is that what he heard from Markham? I just want to get...
At the sentencing hearing, Officer Wixom testified... Officer Markham and Brown went to the back bedroom, and I followed behind them. And once you got into the bedroom, could you see Lakeisha Brown? Yes, I could. And then he described her actions. And then he said, Lakeisha always knows he keeps it in this compartment of the desk and that she can't find it now, and she meant him being Quentin Lomax. And then I asked Officer Wixom, well, how did you know that? And you're right, Your Honor. He said because Officer Markham had told me that's who she said the gun belonged to. But then I went on to ask, but did you eventually find the gun? And he said, yes. I lifted up the mattress, and that's where the gun was found. Was Ms. Brown subsequently asked who the gun belonged to? Yes. What did she say? Quentin Lomax. So you had both Officers Markham and Officer Wixom testify to that at the sentencing hearing.
Now, let me ask you this, Mr. Rumbelow. What you've described to us as occurring at the sentencing hearing about all these exchanges between the officer and Ms. Brown, is the government aware of that at the time they enter into this plea agreement?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, those
And is the plea agreement to dismiss the gun charge and recommend that he receive the maximum reduction for acceptance of responsibility?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you're aware of all this evidence indicating that it's his gun?
Correct.
And you're going to recommend the acceptance of responsibility when you after you dismiss the gun charge?
Yes, because...
So then we get a PSR, right?
Right.
Which, in effect, supports what you knew when you entered into the plea agreement.
That's correct.
Right.
But again, our plea agreement could not have. But let me bet. Our plea agreement could not have been any more clear, Your Honor. It says we're going to make our full file available to the probation office. That includes the police report that Officer Markham had prepared.
And of course, that's not spelled out what it includes.
It's our full file. It's the discovery. Everything that's been provided to the defendant during the discovery process.
I understand it. I know the defense attorney understands it. You know, my concern is whether the defendant understood what the full file was and that the full file included the report, and the implication was that the gun could be used at the sentencing when this has been his big concern and why he didn't plead to it, or at least he contested it. I mean, his position has been pretty consistent throughout this thing that it wasn't his gun.
Well, no. At the sentencing hearing, the government also introduced a copy of a conversation that Quentin Lomax had with Lakeisha Brown early on, where he never denied that the gun was his, but he was trying to get her to take the rap for it. He's like, because I'm a felon and I'm going to catch a Fed case.
In other words, you had a recording of the, or transcript anyway, of the telephone conversation.
I have the recording and the transcript.
From the Madison or wherever.
Dane County Jail, where he was trying to get her to take the rap for it, and nowhere in the conversation did he say. But again, whether the gun is his doesn't mean he didn't possess it. Whoever owned the gun, maybe his friend lent it to him.
It seems to me the strongest evidence you have is the fact that he tried to influence the witness, not the fact that he had the gun.
That's correct. And then the affidavit that they submitted from Lakeisha Brown, this came up during Mr. Cornea's argument. This is what she said in the affidavit. She never says the gun is hers. She says, the gun found under my mattress did not belong to Quentin Lomax. And I'm quoting this, I have never seen Quentin Lomax with a gun. That was her affidavit, which directly contradicted the statement that she made to two Madison police officers on November 15th, 2005. And again, yes, the government entered into a standard plea agreement. You plead guilty to one count, the other count is dismissed.
You knew that they were going to use the gun as an enhancement, right?
Under 2D1.B1, yes, but that's part of the sentencing guidelines, relevant conduct.
I understand why it'd be used, but you had the obstruction of justice thing with his telephone conversation with the witness, too. Right?
No, but it wasn't clear that it was obstruction at that time, and that's not what the obstruction of justice enhancement was based on. It was that he submitted this affidavit from Lakeisha Brown as well as another one at the sentencing hearing. And then she went on to say, Quentin Lomax did not reside permanently at my apartment, and he only spent 2 to 3 nights a week at my apartment. And Judge Shabazz found, I mean, the clearly contradicted statements the defendant made under oath at the plea hearing.
This transcript for the phone conversation in the jail, is this in the, because maybe I just missed it.
It should be. They were marked as exhibits at the sentencing hearing.
Ms. Rumlow, is experienced defense counsel handling this case below?
Pardon me?
Does an experienced defense counsel handling this below? Who is the trial defense counsel?
It was attorney Christopher Malloy, and I have absolutely no idea how long he's been practicing law.
And the government, you know, it's obviously the government's decision to take, you know, proceed with one count. Did the cocaine charge bring a greater sentence than the gun charge?
It carried a mandatory minimum 5-year term of imprisonment because it was greater than 5 grams of crack cocaine. And again, under the sentencing guidelines, 1B1.3, relevant conduct. The 2D...
Perhaps I don't know where my colleagues are exactly at on this. My concern is about a possible misleading, not about mm-hmm. relevant conduct. Mm-hmm. I have no question that this setting of the gun could easily, in many situations, be relevant conduct. What my concern is, you know, whether Mr. Lomax is on board with what he's facing when he comes before Judge Sabas.
Right.
If he was misled, it was not anything that the government did. The terms of our plea agreements are plain. The Judge Sabas, engages in a very thorough Rule 11 colloquy, line by line, sentence by sentence. He goes above and beyond. He says, do you understand? Again, the United States has made no promises or guarantees which sentence will be imposed. Do you understand that if you're expecting a certain sentence, in some cases I can go below or I can go above? Do you understand that we're going to be using the sentencing guidelines? Have you discussed the sentencing guidelines with your attorney?
Right. The problem is there was no discussion of the gun in any of that. It's not identified in the relevant conduct that the gun might potentially be discussed.
No, because my Rule 11 proffer is to the count that he's pleading guilty to, and that was the crack cocaine.
What was the outstanding warrant, Ms. Rumbelow, that they were seeking to arrest him on?
He had absconded from either parole or probation for over a year.
What's his criminal history?
He was criminal history category 5, I believe.
Well, I mean, is he unfamiliar with the criminal justice system?
He's got... armed robbery with threat of force. He was convicted in 2000 at the age of 18. It was a home invasion. He had battery conviction in 2003. He also knowingly violated a domestic abuse order. And as it related to the armed robbery conviction, he was in and out of court many times because he was released to intensive sanctions. Then a revocation warrant was issued. His extended supervision was revoked. He had 1 year in prison. He was released. It was to extend his supervision. Anyway, it goes on and on.
Right.
He's had a lot of experience with the criminal justice system.
So I'm still looking for this transcript in your supplemental appendix, so it must be in the full appendix of the transcript of the conversation at the jail.
That would be part of the record because,
the full record. Okay, I wanted to reference it here.
It was part. And so by the time he entered a plea, he knew what the government's discovery file consisted of, and the government did nothing to mislead him or induce him.
No, I'm not so concerned about whether there's any intentional misleading. I'm not suggesting that, Ms. Rumbelow. At least my focus is on where Mr. Lomax is when he makes this plea and how knowledgeable and, you know, he is. With his background, it's kind of interesting the government makes its decision on the gun charge, where you make a pretty strong case that you had a good gun charge, but that's that's another branch of government. Not, you know, we don't make that call here, but you made that call. So
it's standard plea negotiation.
It's an interesting factual case with a very, very strong evidence that you might have gone forward with on the gun charge. So it builds your case for relevant conduct, but it also raises the specter of why I can see where Lomax was pretty uneasy about anything about the gun, because, you know, he's faced with what you suggest is pretty strong evidence of his possessing the gun.
Yes.
And the government decides not to indict.
We did indict him.
Not to proceed on the gun charge. I can't get there. That's the Attorney General and all his assistants, including you, make that call. But I am trying to understand where he would be at, thinking he's going into a plea on where the government, quote, dismisses it, and then is going to be faced with this substantial relevant conduct evidence on the gun.
But this is in every single case because
of
the sentence.
He got 5 years?
No, he got 162 months. Out of, but approaching the sentencing hearing, his guideline range would have been probably like 7 years, but because he then did not get acceptance of responsibility and the district court found he obstructed justice by submitting two false affidavits from Lakeisha Brown. And again, Judge Shabazz made a very good record. These affidavits submitted were directly contradictory to statements he made.
I don't have any problem with the record that Shabazz made. I don't have any problem where Judge Flom is. I'm troubled because I think that he thought that when the gun thing was dismissed, he was done with the gun.
No,
and that it was not going to be part of it. Well, it's certainly, it's not, I understand the full file. Okay, let me ask you this. When you say the full file, was what was listed in the full file tended to the defense attorney? The items that were in the full file, were they listed?
Not in the plea agreement.
No, and I'm just saying, was there any paper that the defense attorney received listing what the contents of the full file was? Of course, I guess...
We just bait stamp our discovery. Here's pages 1 through 200. They're fully aware of it. But again, our plea agreements and the district court judge says the sentencing guidelines are going to be applied.
Yeah, but they don't say anything about the fact that the gun is going to be included in that for relevant conduct. That's what we understand, that the plea is the plea in terms of going through all the steps, the judge certainly went through all the steps that are normally required. It's just the context of this thing that bothers us.
But the sentencing guidelines include 1B1.3, relevant conduct. And in fact, that's what it includes. And when the judge says, have you and your attorney talked about the sentencing guidelines? And a defendant says yes. And he's under oath. It seems, the judge relies on the fact that the defendant understands the guidelines. He's talked to his attorney about them.
With the acceptance of responsibility, about 7 years he would have gotten? Is that what?
Without an obstruction of justice enhancement.
With the...
With acceptance of responsibility and without the 3C1.1 enhancement, his sentence, I think the guideline range was around 6 to 7, 8 years.
With the relevant conduct?
With the relevant conduct.
Right. So that's what I'm asking. So and what's a gun charge carry? Felon possession.
Well, see, because he pled guilty to count one.
I'm just trying to figure out what he gained by if he'd gone to trial and been convicted of both the cocaine and the gun.
It would have been the same result because let's say, as I point out in my brief, let's pretend he had actually been acquitted of the felon in possession charge at trial. Under Watts, he can still be sentenced for that under the sentencing guidelines, under 1B1.3. And had he gone to trial, convicted of both counts, the pre-sentence investigation report would have been identical to what it was with the plea to count one the plea to count two and the dismissal of count one. It wouldn't have made a difference.
What did he gain? What was his benefit by pleading guilty?
Well, he should have had acceptance of responsibility. But then he went on to frivolously deny relevant conduct.
I understand that, but if I'm sitting, if I'm looking at one sentence under this circumstance, and another one, or if I just go to trial, what did he gain by pleading guilty?
Well, he should have gained the 3-level reduction for acceptance of responsibility. That's what he would have gained. That's typical.
And that sentence would have resulted in what, Mr. Rumbleau? This is, what, nearly 15 years?
Correct.
So if he had the acceptance of responsibility, it would be about half of the sentence?
When the PSI, when it first came out and recommended the 2-level enhancement for 2D1.1, it did give him 3 levels off for acceptance, and it did not attribute a 2-level enhancement for obstruction. And the resulting guideline range initially was 84 to 105 months. But because of the false affidavits and the conduct, he ended up with the guideline range of 135 to 168 months. I ask that you affirm the judgment and conviction order. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rumble. Mr. Cornea, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute if you want to. Okay.
Mr. Lomax felt like he had the rug pulled out from underneath him. Yes, he's had a criminal history background, but the federal system is much different than the state system, and expectations are often...
Is this the first federal charge he's faced?
To my understanding, it is his first federal charge. Moreover, in regards to the jailhouse tape, which you'll see the transcript of, that can be interpreted many ways. It can be interpreted as a defendant saying, look, you need to stand up and take responsibility for your gun, because I'm going to go to jail for X amount of extra time. It's not clear that he was saying
to
Ms. Brown.
It sounds like he's aware, though, that gun may surface in the time of sentencing. Then
he is aware of that, as far as I understand.
So that doesn't undercut the issue of whether he's going to be blindsided by relevant conduct with the gun.
Well, I think he was blindsided.
Whatever the interpretation of that affidavit in the jail.
Yeah, I think he was blindsided by the fact that he felt he had done nothing different than what he had maintained from the very beginning of this case. The gun was not his. There's nothing to indicate that he changed that position.
What's the timing on the jailhouse conversation? You know, what's the timing of it? Does this take place after the after the plea, then the PS?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know. In closing, I just think that when an individual feels, as Mr. Womack does, that he's been railroaded, that he should be allowed to go to trial. That was his intention in the first place.
Well, at some point he agreed to plea.
He did agree to plea. But, you know, this goes to in the guideline line, he had every right to challenge that gun issue. And he did so, and it's his feelings that the gun's not his. It's Miss Brown's feelings that the gun's not his. And
but the ultimate challenge is that you don't have to worry about relevant conduct. You just go to trial on a gun charge.
Right.
Yeah.
Go to trial on a gun charge.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, our thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.